Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Today on Basic, we welcome stand-up comedian and Chappelle Show co-creator, Neil Brennan.
They're not going to want to pay both of us. The spirit was sort of ruined and the relationship was sort of ruined. I would have preferred a bit of respect paid. I don't see how you could have come to a different outcome. People go, do you know where he is? I'd be like, I do. And they go, can you tell me? I go, no, but it's pretty commensurate with how insane the show is. Somebody referred to it as a catastrophic success.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Basic. I'm Doug Herzog, former TV executive and the guy who once tried to pay Dave Chappelle $50 million.
And I'm Jen Chaney, a TV critic for Vulture and New York Magazine, and someone who is trying to convince Doug Herzog to pay her $50 million.
Jen, you are worth every penny of it. Basic is the official podcast of the unofficial history of basic cable television. We talk about everything from MTV to Mad Men, exploring the shows, networks, personalities, and milestone moments that define TV in the glorious era of basic cable.
Our guest today is Neil Brennan, a noted stand-up comedian in his own right, but also the co-creator of the legendary Chappelle Show on Comedy Central, which, amazingly, lasted only two seasons, but remains one of the funniest, most influential, and controversial shows ever to grace the cable dial.
The show really burned bright like a comet, and then it all went down in flames. But nearly 20 years later, its iconic sketches and incredible comedic moments remain unforgettable and still endure with the audience.
It's amazing that the show went off the air so long ago, and yet there's still so much mystery and misinformation about how all of that went down. So I'm extra excited to hear the story firsthand from today's guest, Chappelle Show co-creator Neil Brennan. Neil Brennan, welcome to Basic. Thanks for being here with us.
Oh my God, it's so good to be here.
So we ask all of our guests this question at the very beginning, which is, do you remember when you got cable television? And what were you excited to watch on cable television, if you can recall?
I will say that we got cable probably in like 1988, 89. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing I remember most, and I don't know if anybody else brought this up, you'd get the free Cinemax Showtime weekend and HBO, and for a young man exploring his sexuality, it was a boom time. You would just get a lot of what we used to call Skinamax, which was naked people on Cinemax.
Right.
Not Basic, of course, but there were naked people. So that's why you had to pay a little extra.
Oh, yeah. That was not Basic. Sorry. Is that a different
one? No. That's perfectly fine. That's perfectly fine. Just for our viewers who may not remember the era when you had to pay extra to see naked people. Hey, you famously grew up in a house of 11 children, right?
Yes.
So, and you were the youngest?
Yeah.
So how did growing up in a household like that, you know, ultimately, you know, sort of influence your comedy and your career choice?
It was, well, it was actually 10, I realize now. I was trying to be agreeable. And then I was like, wait a minute.
So you were one of 10, not 11.
Yeah, I'm one of 10. Yeah.
Got it.
Oh, well, the question is no longer interesting. So now.
I think that my TV experience was I was not, like, I don't think I watched a lot of Sesame Street, because there was one TV and I was not given any precedent in terms of what I wanted to watch. So it was like a lot of like Barnaby Jones and Hill Street Blues. There was not a lot of puppets. There was not a lot of education. It was just like cops, a lot of cops.
You went to film school at, I think, NYU, am I right?
Yeah. Yes.
So I was reading an interview where you said the following thing. When I was in film school, I walked out of Wayne's World and I said, and I still kind of believe this, that's the best movie I've ever seen. Do you still believe that?
I still kind of believe. I didn't say that. I said that 4 months ago.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah. I still kind of believe. There was an article about it the other day where it was like, this movie aged so well. And it's just a really, it's like the, it was like a, it's almost like the Easy Rider of comedy or something. Like there's the types of jokes that are in it didn't exist before, as far as I can remember, on in movies. It was like it was kind of like Airplane, but also like a real narrative with sketches.
Big pieces, big production pieces.
Yeah, big production pieces, but also just like two endings, like an Oscar clip. Like just a lot of crazy, even Mike does a, there's a joke in it where he says, he meets Cassandra and there's a joke, there's a fight in the bar and he goes like, and Mike goes, ooh, everyone was kung fu fighting, and realizes that it's a racist joke. And this is in 1991. Like you could kind of do that joke now.
Kind of.
I mean, no, you would, but it's like he literally cringes, like, ugh, yeah, I should have said right. To this Asian girl I just met. Like, there's a lot of, it's just an incredibly sophisticated movie that's kind of ahead of its time. It's, in a weird way, it's more progressive than Austin Powers, which was...
Yeah, I think that's true.
Or 8 years later. It's like about media more than anything else Mike did.
It's also about cable, which we love.
Of course.
So around this time, your brother was working as a stand-up comedian, right?
Yes, and it still is.
Right, and so was that your sort of gateway into the world you're in now?
Yes, that was absolutely. I used to go to New York on the weekends when I was in high school, and my brother was a doorman at the Improv with Dave Attell, and it was, you know, so I would see like Ray Romano would give us a ride home, Dennis Leary. I mean, guys that like, and then when I went to NYU, I started working the door at a comedy club through my brother and a guy named Jason Steinberg and a guy named Barry Katz. And the only other guy my age was Dave Chappelle, and like Jay Moore was around, but the average show was like Sarah Silverman, Jon Stewart, Dave Chappelle.
And this was at the Comedy Six. Comedy Cellar.
This
right?
was at the Boston Comedy Club. Which was like the knockoff Comedy Cellar. It's like two blocks away. And
I remember cheaper. That place.
Louis C.K. and I worked on one of Louis's short films when I was in college. Like, so it was my choice was like, well, these guys seem, Louis C.K. and Dave Chappelle seem more talented than anyone at film school.
Do you remember when you and Dave Chappelle first connected? Like, even like maybe the first conversation you had, or like, did you know right away, like, oh, I have a good rapport with this person?
I don't remember the first conversation. I remember like the first sort of clump of interactions. Like, well, we would just kind of like walk around and I don't know. I don't remember the exact, I think he was playing music with my roommate, Randy Perlstein.
Dave was playing, what did he play? Or what does he
play? Dave played, I think he was trying to play organ, maybe. Randy was trying to play sax. One of them, somebody was playing something. I mean, it didn't last. It wasn't like, hey, I've got the recordings right here. it didn't, they were just noodling around. But I think he claims I got him smoking. He either claims I'm the first person who made him smoke or drink coffee, which is, they're both so odd to me. I think I saw the first time he smoked weed.
Oh, wow. Believe.
Yeah, which seems historic now.
Yeah, absolutely.
But back then, we were just smoking weed with one of the hosts of a Comedy Central show, a guy named Wally Collins. We smoked weed. And Wally Collins, I believe, hosted Stand Up on Comedy Central.
I think that's right.
But it was 1992, I believe.
And what was your impression of his comedy?
Oh, he was great. Dave was great, you know, back then. Not like I'm trying to curry favor, but it's not. My brother said something interesting about Dave, which is, and he said it back then, which is he's the only person I've ever seen make the whole room laugh. Meaning No one kills 100% for the most part, but he used to be able to kill 100%. There were no, like, there's always like a bit of a dead spot in a room, or like that section isn't laughing very hard or whatever. Dave never, there was never a thud. Dave had a joke in high school that he told me about. It's like, if you're wondering how funny he was, he had a joke when he was in high school, when he started doing stand-up. He'd been doing it probably 4 or 5 years when I met him, but that if the TV show Alf was popular, and he's, it's a good thing Alf landed in a white neighborhood, because if he landed in a black neighborhood, 2 weeks later, you would see brothers wearing Alf skin coats. He didn't say brothers, but you get the idea.
There we go.
So yeah, like he was pretty, he had it pretty together in terms of comedy.
You know what, that Alf joke is still relevant because they're bringing Alf back. So he can just recycle really? That joke. They really are.
I
think he has more material now.
I think he's got a new opener.
Yeah, there you go.
Or maybe a closer, who knows?
We'll get back to Dave in a minute, but you had a basic cable career long before the Chappelle Show. You actually started out, I believe one of your first writing gigs was on Singled Out.
Yes. I was working for a casting director and on Singled Out, and they were looking for a writer's assistant, and I was like, you know, well, I write. And this is, I guess, 93. I moved to LA in 93. I guess it was 94, maybe 95. So I became a writer's assistant, and then both writers quit. So I was still a writer's assistant.
For those who may not remember, could you describe
MTV Singled Out?
What was it?
Yes, it was hosted by Chris Hardwick and Jenny McCarthy, who you may know as a doctor, Dr. Jenny McCarthy. She's a virologist, apparently. It was like 50 people, and then they narrow it down to one person. And it was just very stupid. I remember when we were doing the pilot, I think this show is going to be very popular. It's very stupid, but I think it's going to be very popular.
Well, it made a huge star out of Jenny.
Yes.
And a star to obviously, you know, also got Chris started.
Well, and, yeah, Jenny was on the cover of Rolling Stone.
Yeah. And our motto back then at MTV was, you know, a show was okay if we thought it was just stupid enough.
Yeah. No, it was like, I'd say it was stupid enough and then some. but it was a good writing staff, and these guys, Kevin Coppola and Heath Seifert, who ended up writing everything at Nickelodeon and probably at Disney now, and Jason Van Oker and Mark Cronin, who Rock of Love, Flavor of Love, Below Deck, me. They were good. It was like the first time I wrote on a TV show, and I was like, I really like these are my people. Like, I really like comedy writers. And then, ironically enough, in the same office, because, you know, it's MTV. MTV Networks had rented out an office building, and there were, you know, 4 empty offices. So they were like, hey, let's put Nickelodeon's all that there. I ended up talking to them, just sort of, you know, gabbing, talking shit, whatever. And I pitched on the first season. They didn't hire me. And then they ended up hiring me for the second season. And I also found out that they stole one of my ideas from my pitch.
Remind people what all that was.
All that was a kids. It was basically like In Living Color for kids. It ended up being a fairly popular sketch called with Kenan Thompson called Pierre Escargot, where he teaches kids from. I pitched Paco Delicious, which was a guy teaching you Spanish. And they stole that and made it Pierre Escargot. Pretty bad theft, if you ask me. Pretty thinly veiled. Like, they took a sketch and put a fake mustache on it. basically. So anyway, I wrote there for a season, I think season two, in Orlando, because I was Nickelodeon. They decided to shoot Universal Studios Orlando. I'm sure there was some tax incentive, something Doug can speak to. some C-suite stuff that I will never understand.
So when you were working on all that, was that your first experience writing sketch comedy?
Yeah. I actually wrote a sketch for a show on MTV called Kamikaze. Doug, you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Me that was and the Ron thing. Gold wrote a sketch, and it was like a Howard Stern thing. And that was like, I like kind of felt like, oh, I kind of can figure this out. But yeah, Nickelodeon was my first writing for a sketch show. And the thing that I took away from that was that I'd be in the room, and it was, you know, the head writer, a guy named Dan Schneider, who was on a sitcom called Head of the Class in the 80s with another exec producer of the show, Brian Robbins, who now I believe is the president of Nickelodeon.
No, Brian Robbins is the president of Paramount Pictures as well as Nickelodeon.
Damn.
He's a mogul.
I should return his call.
They should have been nicer to him.
What's funny is they used to just abuse me in a very funny, what now we call abuse, then I just thought was funny. Brian Robbins actually said something really funny, because I would never get sketches on. And Brian Robbins said at one point, he goes, I should have fired you when I had the chance. Which is really funny.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. No, it's funny. In retrospect, it's funny. It was actually funny that Dan, they used to throw food at me. They called me the boy because I was younger than them. I was probably 20 or 21. But what I learned from that was that, you know, we'd be rewriting a sketch and I'd have an idea and I wouldn't pitch it. And then 6 minutes later, somebody else would pitch the same idea and they would get on and be like, just, you should trust your ideas more. So that was sort of, it was, Doug, I don't know if you guys have covered this, but these networks were sort of AAA or a farm league or incubator for
1,000%
for, other shows, obviously, but Kimmel being a good example of like, you know, a network show or whatever. Like there was, I think there was a lot of writers got started on cable in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
I want to talk to you a little bit about Half Baked. And yes. I want to lead into this by saying that I was at the Mark Twain Prize ceremony a couple years ago when Dave was honored. My regular job is writing for Vulture and New York Magazine. And I wrote a piece for Vulture specifically about how great your speech was.
Oh, you wrote like the funniest headline ever, Neil Brennan was the funniest person at the Mark Twain Prize. Or it was so direct. That it was like, it just felt like a bot wrote it in a good way.
I don't know if I wrote that one. I don't always get to write the headlines, but I'll take credit
for it. I remember it was just kind of a transcript of what the speech was. Right. But it was great. It was like, I was very grateful that you wrote that.
So part of what I referenced in that article was your story about how Half Baked came about, which I thought mm-hmm. was very funny. Mm-hmm. Can you regale us with that again?
Yeah, basically me and Dave kind of talked about doing something together. Like we've written some jokes for his act here and there, but not even nothing like wholesale or whatever. And then he was like, hey, the part I didn't say, but it's barely relevant, is we had seen the movie Trainspotting. Okay. And then when we were leaving, he was like, you can make a weed movie of that. And I was like, yeah, that's true. And then 6 months later or something, he calls me and goes, hey, Universal calls, tell them we're writing a weed movie. And I was like, what weed movie? And he was like, I don't know. Don't worry about it. And so then Universal called me, Bob Simons, the producer, his office called me and they were like, are you writing a weed movie with Dave Chappelle? And I was like, yes. And they're like, when can you pitch it? And I didn't really understand deadlines. So I just made up one, which is in 30 days time. I just decided that if we had 30, like that seemed like the right amount of time. And then we waited until night 29 to outline it. Actually, we spent all day. Let's give credit where credit's due. We started 1 in the afternoon. and we laid out the outline in like 12 hours. And I think that commitment to quality really showed up on screen. And then we pitched it the next day, and Bob bought it. And then we had pitched it at Universal and Disney, and Disney liked it. Dave had a deal there, whatever. But yeah, so that was in I believe March, and then we were shooting in July, which is insane.
I read somewhere that when you were shooting it in Toronto, right?
Yeah.
That Norm Macdonald and Saget were making Dirty Work, and you were all staying at the same hotel.
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely true. And I think Norm didn't like me for a long time because he gave me the script for Dirty Work, and like I couldn't read it. I like couldn't get my head. I just was so in up to my neck in our movie that like reading his movie was just like, that's why Saget's in Half Baked.
Because he was there.
Because he was there. Yeah, he was there shooting Dirty Work.
Got it. Then you and Dave, at least sort of, you know, for public projects, there was a little bit of a break before you got together on the Chappelle Show.
Yeah, that was a public. I mean, we didn't really work together. It was a bad work situation where, like, basically we were supposed to write another movie for Universal, and then I became like the hammer for me and Dave writing. Like I was like the taskmaster, and Dave's dad was dying, and I wasn't very sympathetic to that. Like, and so I was just kind of like good. So we just kind of stopped fucking with each other for a year or two.
All right. So tell us about getting back together with him, you know, around the Chappelle Show.
Yeah. He called me and was like, hey, we should do like a Playboy After Dark. You know, it's not even a thing that you get good at, but I think if a friend has an idea, it very rarely works out well, but if they have an idea and you're like, maybe I can talk them into something else. Let me just go along with this and maybe it'll morph into something better. And I didn't even have like that wasn't consciously my thinking. I just wanted to do some with them. And we ended up pitching. It was basically like, what bits do you have? What bits do I have? Like laying around. I had like a Kinko's video that I wanted to make because the Kinko's customer service is so bad that I wanted to make, that I like scouted locations for that I was going to shoot. And he had the bloopers from Roots as a sketch idea and maybe the reparations.
Wow.
Like what would happen if reparations happened? What would actually like, what would the news look like? So I think with that, we pitched Comedy Central. We pitched, I think, Lou Wallach at Comedy. We pitched HBO. I won't say who, but I mentioned this in the Mark Twain speech, and she said, why do we need you when we have Chris Rock?
Ouch.
Which is a fine, good for Chris. You know, as I'm a huge fan.
But also short-sighted, one of my bosses, who I will not name, once said to me, well, do you need both Colbert and Jon Stewart?
Yeah, there you go.
I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're both great. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, what was that for the 11:30, or that was just you had to pay Stephen to stay on The Daily Show?
The latter.
Got it. Yeah. I'm not going to defend what he said, but I hear it. Like, if you're like, why would I give a correspondent that much money? I get that.
No. This was later. This was when they were both on. I'm sorry. They were both on. We were paying them a lot of money, by the way, well-deserved. They were doing great. There was nothing bigger and better in late night television. And I had a guy who thought we could, you know, do it for half the price with half the guys.
Yep. So we walked up Sixth Avenue, literally walked up Sixth Avenue. It was like maybe July or August. It was so hot. And I just remember thinking, like, I was crazy because Dave, I was like, he's so funny. Like, what am I out of my mind? There's a window in here that we didn't talk about, which was before Spell Show. I wrote a couple movies and one of them I sold to MTV Films or something with a guy named Mike Schur. And we pitched a movie probably in 2000 for Dave Chappelle and Will Ferrell two different producers that week said, could it be Tom Green and Orlando Jones?
Holy God.
And it was one of these things where you're just like, we would look at each other like, are we crazy? Like, have we lost our minds? Because, like, I know Mike worked at SNL at the time, knew how funny Will was. I worked with Dave. I knew how funny he was. And I was like, is the world just going to become a world that we don't understand? And Tom Green was fucking great.
I was going to say, he was probably having his MTV moment.
Yeah, no, Orlando. He was having his moment, but it was just one of these things where, like, so that's, you won't even consider Dave and Will?
Yeah.
I don't know. It was just
And by the way, Orlando Jones, I think, was doing a 7-Up commercial.
Yes, God bless. But it's just a weird thing. Even Orlando probably would have been like, use Dave. So walking up Sixth Avenue, and then we went to Comedy Central and pitched to Lou Wallach, and he seemed enthusiastic. And of course, the person at HBO always says, like, I helped them get their pitch together. They didn't. It was verbatim the same. So, and then we did the pilot that summer of 2002. Yeah. That's just my only recollection is like doing the pilot. Pilot's not bad. Didn't have an audience, but like sketches were the ones I pitched. Bloopers from Roots, Kinko's, and Reparations. Wraparounds were just Dave talking to camera, just like wherever. We both watched it and we're like, we feel like it needs an audience. And then so we still had the sketches and then got picked up for 13. And apparently Dave did Conan O'Brien, and Conan's like, who are you going to write it with? And he's like, I'm writing with this guy, Neil. And he's like, anybody else? He's like, no. And he's like, don't do it that way. Don't do it. Like an old man in a horror movie. Like, no, don't do it. Don't go up there. I stand by. I mean, it was like, we'd take outside pitches from people, and there were some very good ones. And but it was hard. But I think the idea was like, even if sketches are not great, they'll be like in the same voice, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I'd say that's fairly true.
So what was your process like? Because when you know you have that many episodes and then several sketches to do for each episode, like, where do you even begin?
Well, you know what's funny? So I think the show got picked up, and Tom Shale's book and Andrew Miller, Live from New York, came out. Mm-hmm. I think that summer. I could be wrong. But as I recall, we got picked up, and I read that book and, like, learned about sketches. That sounds insane. But, like, kind of learned, like, oh, there's, like, performance pieces, and then there's, like, premise pieces, and then there's more audio, you know, like, types of sketch, like a living room sketch or the commercial parody, or like just kind of thinking about it in different ways. But in essence, it was kind of like, you know, it was hand to mouth. I mean, we didn't really, when people are like, did you gotta have an elaborate process? We had two types of sketches, longies and shorties. That's how thought out this was.
So we're getting to a part of the conversation where I feel like both you and Doug may be able to participate in this together. But so after season 2, when Dave renegotiated his deal for a reported $50 million, and then the taping for season 3 got delayed a little bit, when you finally got back to work, did it feel like anything was different or had changed?
Yes, in that and Doug can speak to this firsthand, the problem, I told Dave before anybody negotiated anything, like during probably the second season, I was like, the only way they're not gonna want to pay both of us, so they're gonna play divide and conquer. And then sure enough, they, like, Dave closed his deal, and then I was offered a horrible, insulting offer. And then I got nominated for a bunch of Emmys. And then I believe I was the most nominated person. And someone called me from Comedy Central to congratulate me. I yelled at them about my offer. And then, Doug, you called me personally. To try to clean up the mess.
Yeah, they came in with a very particular strategy just around Dave.
Rather than you and Dave, which is fine. But the problem was the way the show operated was like it was very conjoined, so to speak.
Right.
So basic, but whatever, that's fine. Like that, you give him all the points and all that stuff you want. But my point ceiling was awfully low.
Right.
There wasn't a lot of like you guys weren't feeling any pressure to make it higher.
Right.
And they weren't. It's just a lot of like they didn't want Dave to think that they everybody's out.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of finger pointing going around. That's for sure. But
right.
Did that change the vibe on the set between you and Dave?
Yeah. It was like then it's like okay, right now go be funny. And it was kind of like okay, how?
So then, right. So you guys went back. I think you were like 2 or 3 episodes in, kind of.
And well, we didn't do any tapings. We just shot a bunch of sketches.
Right.
And I actually stand by the sketches. I think the sketches are very funny. So
sketches are good.
And then it was just slowly, like me and him, our relationship sort of diminished. And like the spirit of the show, the spirit was sort of ruined. And the relationship was sort of ruined. I don't see how you could have come to a different outcome. Maybe, I don't know. Like,
that's
funny.
One of my questions was going to be, you know, do you think as you look back, could have actually ended any other way? And I think about that a lot about, okay, what could I have done differently? What could Comedy Central have done differently? You know, what could the agents have done differently or Neil and Dave? And so I don't know the answer. I'm just wondering whether that's something you feel you have a point of view on.
Well, I don't think, you know, again, it's like from if I'm you and there's this like supernova of a show that's very like personality driven or like he's the star of the show, like unequivocally and an unbelievable, you know, once in a millennium comedy talent. What are the odds I'm talented also? Yeah. What are the fucking odds? So which I've had to like slowly prove over time, like, okay. But so I think I would have preferred a bit of like respect paid, but you guys didn't have to because he would have done the show without me, allegedly. I mean, again, one of these things, like, I don't know what I was in an impossible position because everyone was trying to placate Dave's ego around are you a team member or are you
right.
just like a
you were not flying with a lot of air cover
yes
is the way I would describe it so that's a tough place to be.
So when Dave actually left, like how did you find that out? Do you remember when you got the news that he was just gone?
I think maybe his manager called me. I was on set. That was what was great about it. I was waiting for him to arrive. And I think his manager told me, but I couldn't tell anyone. So I was just like, he's not around. People go, do you know where he is? I'd be like, I do. And they go, can you tell me? I go, no, but it's pretty commensurate with how insane the show is. Like if you had to pick a place to go for like, what's a cartoonish, everything about the show was cartoonish. The success, the somebody referred to it as a catastrophic success.
I love that.
Yeah. Like the where he went and the thing, Oprah and the.
Did you think he was coming back?
No.
Never thought he was coming back.
No, I never thought for a second he was coming back.
So that was that.
Yeah, I just knew because it was so like our relationship was so. Decimated by the time he leaves that it's like it wasn't shocking to me.
Right.
I mean it was shocking but it wasn't surprising. It was inevitable in some way.
I feel like Dave talked about this maybe even on Oprah but certainly elsewhere where he talked about how the way the jokes were landing were certain people in the audience and he felt like they weren't laughing at them for like the right reasons. Mm-hmm. Do you think that was a factor in this as well? I mean, did you have a sense of that?
There was one incident where someone laughed that, you know, but the person had like a, just had a condescending laugh by nature from the first time we ever met them. But if you're, if you feel bad about it, then you take it and you, you can spin it, you know?
Sure.
But I also don't envy his position of being like, you know, the spokesman for the standard bearer for a entire race of people.
Right. I mean, and I also think that a lot of the comedy from that time, I mean, you can say this about South Park too, I think. People, there were people that would understand when they were doing satire, and then there were people who were laughing, again, for the wrong reasons. And both of those sets of people were watching the show. So I can understand, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't, I think that it's a lot more people are watching for satire. If if I believe you're going to have like some collateral damage of people that are watching it for, basically it's like a version of hate watching something.
In the old days, they used to say that about All in the Family.
Right. The right. people that agreed right. with, you know, right. like the joke was on Archie.
Except if you agreed with them.
Yeah. And then it was, you know, and then it was like, yeah. And then it was like, yeah, this guy's talks a lot of it, but it's like, you see the show from his point of view instead of Mike's point of view or Gloria. I'm just making names up.
No, that's, those are correct names.
Oh, good for me.
What's your relationship like with Dave these days? You guys have kind of come all the way around, right?
Yeah. Yeah, good. It's all like, you know, fine. No, you know, it's sort of like kind of hard to describe because it's a very, he's a very specific guy. So I guess I'm specific too. I don't know. It's a bit like, it's like guys that want a championship together or something.
Right.
In sports. It's right. just a bit of like a,
we're in the foxhole together. A lot of time together, had each other's back, you know, made a run. Never forget.
Yep. Yep. People still like it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So you've done a ton of things, Neil. I wish we had time to talk about everything. You write, you direct, you produce, you act, you do stand up. But you've been spending a lot of time over the last couple of years, doing some off-Broadway presentations of your comedy. And you recently finished something in New York called Unacceptable. Can you tell us about that and what the plans are?
Yes. Did Unacceptable in New York for 77 shows. I don't know how many. It was a long time. Going to do it in LA soon. I'm announcing soon, I guess. And then I'm going to tour it a little bit. And then it'll live on a streamer that I cannot name. Or I don't want to name it because I don't want people to be like, well, just wait. why would I go see it when I can wait? So it may never air on a streamer, but between you and me, it's going to air on a streamer.
This may be a weird subject to finish up on, but both in your comedy and, you know, just kind of out there well, I've heard you on podcasts previously, you talk a lot about mental health. So could you talk a little bit about why that's so important to you and why you have become so comfortable talking about it?
I'm not embarrassed. Like, I'm the youngest of 10, as you mentioned. So I'm almost from a different world than some of my older brothers and sisters. So like when I went to therapy and started taking medication for depression, they were like, wait, what are you doing? How long are you going to do this for? It turns out like 20 years. I'd already kind of breached it with them in terms of like society doesn't really like talking about it, like in general. Now they're getting more comfortable with it. The ironic thing is I did a joke last night about how much like mental health has entered sports and how we want our athletes to be mentally healthy. And my point is like, no, I don't. Michael Jordan's not mentally healthy. He's a fucking psycho. And that's what I'm looking for.
Not Ben Simmons.
No, well, Ben Simmons is like, he's hiding behind it, but yeah, there's a few people. It's like Tom Brady, not a healthy person. Beautiful, great looking, not healthy. So I don't have a problem talking about it. I think it's important and I think it's like relevant to talk about. And I had stuff I wanted to say in public about it as like a, in sort of using it within telling my own personal story. So I have no shame about it. And people have kind of, I don't think I kicked the door down, but I was pretty early through the door in terms of like talking about it in public.
Yeah.
Because I just don't, I think it's like, you know, tennis elbow or something. I don't see it as a deficiency. I don't see it as like, and that, do you guys still like me? Like, I don't see it as.
Well, like many things on that, you were ahead of the curve. I mean, it's a thing now. People talk about it. Yeah. It's out there and it's a good thing. I have one question we did forget to ask you, which is how we usually end, which is, excluding your shows, what is your all-time favorite basic cable television show?
It's a great question. I would say Making Da Band on MTV with Puff Daddy, which we did a sketch about. I was a perennial Real World watcher for a long time, until that's a funny like passage in life where you just go, I don't care about these people anymore. When you're like in your late 30s, you go, you know what? I don't give a shit.
You do age out of that shit.
Behind the Music is another basic classic.
Yeah. Right. Well, Neil, I owe you a lunch at Crossroads or something.
You owe me nothing, Doug. All right. Very good.
We appreciate it, man.
All right. Thanks a lot, Neil. So it was really interesting to me to hear directly from Neil about especially the ending of Chappelle's Show and how all of that happened. And I don't know, I just think it's such a shame that it seems like he and Dave really did not communicate with each other when things got crazy right before the show ended.
Yeah, look, it's a story that you hear often in showbiz when things take off. And in this case, take off very quickly. Everybody loses their head a little bit and they both went to their corners. They've patched it up since then. But during that time, there was not a lot of communication going on and it felt like it wasn't the same.
Yeah, and it's understandable, like, since Dave Chappelle obviously was the star of the show. But I can see how, as the co-creator, Neil would have felt pushed out of the way a little bit.
1,000%. I mean, I think a very tough position to be in. He was flying without a lot of air cover. Everybody was most concerned about Dave. There were a lot of people who thought he can do it without Neil. Who knows whether that's true or not. But I think for Neil, who is the guy behind the scenes, that's always a tough place to be.
Yeah. And another thing that's so remarkable to me is for a long time, I feel like people were like, when is Chappelle's Show going to come back? There was this sense of hope that like maybe Dave Chappelle will resurrect it. I felt like certainly after this conversation, it was clear to me that that's just never going to happen. Both of them are doing different things and the Chappelle Show is just part of their past.
Yeah, I don't think Dave is ever coming back to television in this way. I think it's a lot of heavy lifting and it's a lot of work. And, you know, Dave's got this great life, which I think is perfect for him, where he can go out and do literally what he does best, better than anybody, anytime he wants, anywhere he wants, and get paid a lot more money than even I was willing to pay him back then. So, you know, I think he found the place where he needed to be. I don't think he's coming back. You know, the sketch format, still a great format. It's probably something I think Neil's interested in. But then again, how can you do better than the Chappelle Show?
Well, and that's the thing. As strong of a stand-up comedian as Dave is, I think he's an incredible sketch performer. A lot of those sketches still hold up beautifully, and he's a big reason why. And so it makes me a little sad to think that we'll never see him do that again, although I guess we occasionally get it when he hosts Saturday Night Live.
Right. Saturday Night Live is sort of the perfect vehicle for him because he can come in a week, get it all done, it's live, and then he can go back to doing what he loves to do and what he does best. You know, Chris Rock once said to me around the time that the show went down that he would never consider a sketch comedy after the Chappelle Show. He thought that was a drop-the-mic sketch comedy, and nobody could do it better than Dave and Neil did it.
Yeah, and again, I'm glad that we talked to Neil because it was Chappelle's show, but it was also Neil's show too, and I'm glad he got a chance to sort of talk about his role in it.
One of the things I kicked myself with that we didn't get to ask Neil about was the music on the show. Mm. They had so much incredible hip-hop. I think that's actually really one of the places that Dave and Neil connected, and it was a really big part of the show. They had a bunch of bands on long before they became huge. Everybody from The Roots to the Beastie Boys.
Tribe Called Quest.
I mean, there were a bunch of them.
Kanye.
And then, of course, Dave went on to make that great movie, Block Party, which almost felt like a spinoff of the Chappelle Show, at least musically.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it was all music, but it was still such fun to watch and just really joyful. And I think that's kind of how Chappelle's Show felt a lot of the time. It was just like a really fun, joyful thing to watch.
There you go. And by the way, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, what a great stand-up Dave is. Neil's a really good stand-up. I've seen him do his one-man show, different ones a number of times. And I would encourage anybody out there who listened to this conversation today and got turned down to Neil Brennan to go check out his stand-up comedy or his one-man show when it comes to your town. He's pretty great.
It was great talking to him. We hope you guys enjoyed it. And we look forward to coming back to you again next week on Basic.
Basic is a Pantheon Media production in partnership with SiriusXM, hosted by Jen Chaney
and Doug Herzog. produced by Christian Swain and Peter Farioli.
Lindley Ehrlich is our assistant producer.
Mixed, mastered, and music by Jerry Danielson.
Edited by Zach Spisner.
You can find Basic on Apple Podcasts, the SiriusXM app, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. If you like the show, please rate, review, and share so other people can find us. Don't forget to follow the show so you never miss an episode.